Hello Terry, this is Dennis Stevens here, and today is the 16th of November 1993, and I was very pleased to receive your very welcome tape this morning. I'm very glad that you sent the tape rather than sent a letter, because communicating by tape is much easier for me these days than writing. With my glaucoma, it's becoming almost impossible these days for me to write and or read. So tapes are always communicating by tape is always very, very welcome. First off, I think we'd better get the business aspect out of the way, Terry. You request some ideas of exchange on the materials on Trom and on the tapes. Look, Terry, the whole of the business side of this is in the hands of Greg. I've done it that way, purposely and intentionally. I simply do not want to get involved with the business side of this. So I've written to Greg today and told him that I've received a letter from a tape from you. And I've told him that I will be telling you in my reply that the matter's in the hands of Greg. So no doubt he'll be in touch with you on this subject. The reason for this, Terry, is very, very simple, that I am in retirement, and I have no idea how much it's costing Greg to prepare these materials. He has his computer there, he has all his paper, and he knows the cost of these materials and the cost of his time and the cost of his labour in getting these materials out to you and so forth. So only he can evaluate this. Also, the matter of royalties is up to Greg too. I've left that entirely in his hands. So the whole thing is, the whole of the business side is in Greg's hands, Terry. So your com should really go to on the business side of your com should have gone to Greg rather than to me. But the remainder of your com was very, 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 very welcome indeed. So do we understand the position there? All business matters go to Greg, and everything else can come to me. I've never been through Kettering. I think I might have passed through Kettering in a train once, or near Kettering. It's in Northants. I think it's on the line from Euston that goes up through to Carlisle on the old London Midland and Scottish line. I think that used to go through Northants, somewhere near Kettering anyway, near Rugby, around that way. So I do know the area of Kettering, but I've never actually stepped off of a railway train in the county of Northants. So I agree with you that it's lovely countryside there. Something that I miss very much is the beautiful green of the English countryside. The green of the Australian countryside is a different green. The grass over here is much coarser because of our much stronger sun, and it's a lighter coloured grass. It's an entirely different type of green. And I miss the old English green of the gentle, delicate English grass. The English grass wouldn't stand an Australian summer. It would simply wither up and die. The sun here is far too strong for the English grass. With some idea of where we are here in Redland Bay, if you take a map of Australia, you dig out your atlas and have a look at the east coast of Australia, round about the most easterly point of Australia, that's round about the northern New South Wales, southern Queensland border, you'll see just north of that little, north of the most easterly extension of the continent, you'll see what looks like a finger, an island, stuck very close to the coast there, running roughly north-south. It's very, very close to the coast. It looks like a finger. Now, that is Stradbroke Island. That is Stradbroke Island. It's a very large island, and it... We're on the coast, on the inward side of that island. So that will give you some idea of where Redland Bay is. Our latitude is, we're 27.5 degrees south of the equator here. which puts us, put that in context from an English point of view, we're at the same latitude, we're at the same distance from the equator, we're at the same latitude as the Canary Islands off the west coast of Africa. So they'll give you some idea of really how close we are to the equator here compared to London. I don't know how many hundreds of miles we are closer to the equator than London or England, but it's many, many hundreds of miles. Our climate here is what is known as subtropical, as compared to England, which is cool, temperate. And that means that even on the coldest of winter's days in July, the temperature can be relied to get up to 65 degrees Fahrenheit during the day. Are you still on the Fahrenheit scale? Even if you've gone over the centigrade, you would still understand the old Fahrenheit scale, because that was the one you were taught at school. So even on the coldest winter's days, the day maximum gets up to 65 in July. But by August, it's getting up to 70 again. By October, it's up to 75 again. So you can see that there's only 2 months of the year where we have anything resembling a winter. And even that is much, much warmer than an English spring or an English autumn. And the rest of the year is summer. I mean, to an Englishman, which I still consider myself to be, the summer starts here in towards the end of September and goes right the way through to around about the end of April, the beginning or the middle of May the following year. So we have a very, very long summer from an Englishman's point of view, and the winter, of course, is non-existent. From an Englishman's point of view, it's a non-existent winter here in Redland Bay. The locals think we have a winter, but they're joking. There's no such thing as a winter here at these latitudes. It's just a joke. The vegetation here, everything grows here, and everything grows enormous. One of the first things I saw when I came up to Redland Bay was a praying mantis sitting on the window pane, on the bush outside the window, and he was all of 12 inches long. So that can give you some idea how big the insects get in subtropical Queensland. Spiders get enormous, and they come in the house. Everything grows big up here. Everything grows big, and all the vegetation grows. And of course, we have the ordinary Australian vegetation here, and then of course, there's the imported plants that people bring in. But mainly, the vegetation here is the ferns of the tropics, which is most noticeable here, more so than in Sydney. It's definitely, the vegetation here is definitely subtropical. Ferns and palm trees and so forth are very, very common here in Redland Bay. They are part of the natural vegetation. Right opposite our house here, there's a banana plantation. And it's a commercial venture. It's a great big banana plantation. And we have bananas growing in the garden. And so forth. Oranges, of course, grow here. But of course, oranges will grow further south in Sydney. But the bananas won't grow in Sydney. It's the trees will grow, but it's too cold for them. But they grow here quite plentifully, bananas. Many of the garden people around here have bananas growing in their gardens. Give you some idea of the different climate here than England. If you ever want to come to southern Queensland, to this part of the world, to Queensland, to Brisbane, the best time of the year to come for an Englishman is September or October. If you were to arrive here in September and October, you'd think you were walking into a beautiful English summer. That's what you'd think. If you come here in November, it's going to be a bit hot. That's our thunderstorm month. The temperature gets up in November. It can get up to 80, 85. By December, it's definitely up into the 80s, and it's getting humid. And the end of December, just around about Christmas, our wet season starts. And all during January, February and March, we get most of our rain during those 3 months. That is definitely our wet season. It varies from year to year. Some years we have a marked wet season, and other times of the year we don't get much at all. But we always get some form of a wet season here. Then it starts to dry out in April, May and June. Our winters are bone dry. There's absolutely no reason why it should rain in Redland Bay in the winter. There's no climatological or meteorological reason why it should rain, and it very rarely does. Our winters are very, very dry here, what we call a winter, very dry. Now spring is dry, September's dry, October's dry, then the storms start in November. We've got them now. They're just coming in now. Last week or so, we've had some storms. And, of course, the great intelligent Australians put all their power lines, all their power cables, they park them up on the top of telegraph poles so the lightning can strike them in the thunderstorm. The wind can come along and blow them over. So every time we have a storm, there's power cuts in Brisbane. And it's a wonderful piece of Australian intelligence, that is. They're really smart, that is, putting their power. They bury their telephone cables here, by the way. They only carry a tiny voltage. So they bury those deeply under the ground in the towns. And but they put their power cables up on poles, which is quite the reverse of what they do in England. In England, in the towns, all the power cables are buried, but the telephone lines are up on poles. Well, we do it the other way around in Australia. So the first thing you do when you hear the thunder going in Australia, in Brisbane, the Brisbane area in November and December, you light up the old oil lamp, because the power's going to go off. It starts to flicker, and then it's gone. And you're out without any power for an hour or so until they get it back right again. But nevertheless, it's a beautiful place to live. It's a beautiful place to retire to. I wouldn't particularly like to live here. I don't think if I was doing if I was a working man here, because it can be unless you're working in an air-conditioned office, conditions can be very, very extreme here in the summer. You've only got to get 10 or 15 or no, 20 miles inland here in the summer, and the temperature's up at 100 Fahrenheit every day. The sun is really fierce, you know, inland in Queensland in the summer. It's bad enough inland in New South Wales, but up here it's really fierce. There's a place called Ipswich, just west of Brisbane. It's only about 20 miles inland, but they're always, even now they're getting temperatures up to up in the 90s. We're only in November. That's quite normal for Ipswich. They're only 20 miles inland. We're spared all that by the sea breeze, of course. The prevailing wind here, fortunately, is off the sea. Our prevailing wind in Eastern Australia is off the sea. Otherwise, Eastern Australia would be uninhabitable, like most of Western Australia is uninhabitable, because their prevailing wind is off the land. That's why Western Australia, the coast of Western Australia, isn't populated, because it's virtually uninhabitable. It's a desert. But because our prevailing wind here is an easterly, southeasterly, nearly all the year round, the coastal region is well watered, and it produces a very beautiful climate. We get about 50 inches of rainfall here a year, about twice England's rainfall, but we certainly need it because of the extreme heat and extreme radiation of the sun. The sun here, it's almost overhead in midsummer, because we're only 27.5 south, we're only 4 degrees, 280 miles south of the Tropic of Capricorn. So the sun virtually overhead, and my God, in December that sun can take the skin off your arms, it can take the skin off your head unless you wear a hat. It's really fierce, our summer sun is here. So it's a very extreme, in that sense, in terms of heat, it's very extreme here in Redland Bay. But nevertheless, it's tempered by the overnight showers. And I suppose really southern Queensland does have, all told, it's probably got one of the best climates in the world. It is a beautiful climate here. I mean, I have to admit that it's a beautiful climate, although it's a little bit too warm for working in. It's a beautiful climate to have a holiday in. But as I say, if you want to come here, the best time for an Englishman is in September and October. If you ever come here, don't come here in January and February. It can rain all the time. That's our wet season. So it's a word of advice. If you want to come here, come in spring. That's September and October. It's lovely to hear an English accent again, Terry. The Australians believe they speak English, but they don't, you know. They speak a dialect of English, which they believe is English. And you hear it all the time, and in the end you don't realise. You begin to think that it's English. It's only when you hear an English voice like yours, you have a very good English accent. You hear a true English accent again. You say, my God, what is it these Australians are speaking? It isn't English. Because my accent is, I've lived out away from England for so long that I only have vestiges of English in my accent. My accent has been adulterated beyond all recognition from what it used to be when I lived in England. So it's lovely to hear an English voice again, an English accent again. I'm going to put up your tape in my other tape recorder and play it through and start making comments on it as I go. Yes, I agree with you. It's very doubtful if in these days in the Scientology, in the HASI, I still call it the HASI, I suppose I ought to call it the Church of Scientology, I still tend to call it HASI because it was a HASI in the days when I worked there. Yes, in the days of the old days, it was not at all unusual to hand out copies of Evolution of a Science and course booklets to new people who came in. I once pinned, when I was the DFT in London, I pinned up on the door of the HPA room that a little notice which read, "The data is free. We only charge you for the time it takes us to teach it to you." I don't suppose that notice is still there. I somehow think that over the years it would have been removed. Yes, it's nice to hear the old names again. Barry Hines, Debbie Hines, they were staff auditors. Mary Long, she was a staff auditor. Of course, I met up with Mary Long in 1962 at St. Hill when I went back over there to do the briefing course. Yes, I did do the briefing course, by the way, Terry, in 1962. And I do agree with you that that St. Hill Manor is a beautiful spot in the Sussex Downs there. In East Grinstead, it's one of the most beautiful spots in southern England, is around that area. Very beautiful. Listening to your background, Terry, unless I missed it, it doesn't sound as if at any time you did professional training. When you went to St. Hill, I listened to it, I thought, oh, you must have gone to St. Hill and done the briefing course, but then again, I heard you were on staff there. Did you do professional training at any time? I'm not quite sure. Perhaps you could clarify that point for me. I was interested listening to your career. You've done a very varied career, haven't you? I used to be, talking about photography, I was very, very interested in photography when I was a young man. That was before before I came across Dianetics and Scientology. I was very interested in weather forecasting. And as a very young person, I was a weather observer. I used to work for Air Ministry. And I used to work for the Met Office. And used to be my hobby as a child was weather. And my main interest in photography was taking photographs of clouds with various types of filters on black and white film. Of course, that was before the days there was... before the days of colour film. Well, not there was colour film, but I'm talking about in the late 1940s, where they hadn't really perfected the colour process, and it was prohibitively expensive anyway, and all the photographs that were being done that you could get developed and so forth. I never did my own developing or printing, but I used to bought myself a decent camera and a decent set of green filters and red filters and yellow filters, and used to take some most astounding photographs of cumulonimbus clouds with white, brilliant white clouds against a black sky. Very dramatic. It's lovely. I lost my collection. I had a beautiful collection of clouds, cloud photographs, cirrus clouds, altocumulus, altostratus, cumulonimbus. Beautiful shots of cumulus clouds. I had a great collection of clouds. Some people have a photo album, you know, of their relations, and you open the album up, there's faces looking at you. You used to open up my little album, there was clouds looking at you. I had a great album of clouds. I thought I'd tell you that. It might amuse you as a photographer. I wonder if you were ever interested in photographing clouds. It's a very odd part of photography, but it's very fascinating. Just like some photographers chase around the world getting interesting angles on birds and animals and so forth, you have to be at the right place at the right time to get a good shot of a cloud too, you know. Yes, you were wondering about our children. Yes, we have three children. There's Michael, he's the eldest, and there's Mimi. You remember Mimi's name after all these years, yes? Mimi's the second, and Tim is the youngest. You don't remember him because he wasn't in London at the time when we were in the org. But they're our three children. And, of course, they're grown up now. They're Michael is... how old is Mike now? He's... he's 54, and Mimi's 52, and Tim is 50. So they're well and truly grown up, all three of them. They're all in Australia. All our children are here in Australia with us. Just flip your tape back to the beginning, see if I've missed anything. And yes, I have. Des Popham. Yes, I remember Des Popham. The name's familiar, but I don't think I've ever met the gentleman. I've seen his name referred to, and he's been around for a number of years, Des has. Poor Des. You've got him to come over on a Sunday, and he's going to look at Trom on a screen, and he's going to evaluate the technical aspect of it. Oh my God, poor Des, poor Des. I really feel for him. I do. I feel for him. Oh, you do drop curves on people, don't you, Terry? You do drop curves on them. You know, it's like, I tell you what, it's comparable to doing. It's like calling in Carl Jung one Sunday to come over and look on a screen and do an evaluation of Sigmund Freud's libido theory. You know, then saying at the end of the day, well, now, what do you think of it? What do you think of it, Mr. Jung? The poor guy's going to say, well, how the hell can he know? He can't evaluate it, Terry. He can't evaluate it until he's tried it. He would have to try it. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. Although my material is very, very close to Scientology, there are a number of differences. There's no contradictions, by the way, between my material and the material of Scientology, which Des will soon spot. There's no contradictions, but nevertheless, there's certain aspects which are brought forward in my material which are not in Scientology. They just weren't there. Ron never found them, and so it's going to be. The only way to evaluate this material is to try it. You can't evaluate it. You can't look at Scientology and look at my material and evaluate my material in terms of what is known of Scientology. You see that? You just can't do it because the bits that are in mine aren't in Scientology. You follow? And the only way to evaluate those is to evaluate them in present time by test. Trial and error test, well, not trial and error, but actually using the techniques, using the procedures, and seeing if they work and seeing what happens when you use them. You can't predict what they're going to do by reference to Scientology, because these bits aren't in Scientology. You see that? You'll discover this when you get to level 5. Levels 1 and 2, yes, you might be able to get this. You could evaluate level 1 in terms of Scientology. And level 2, you could, yes, you could possibly do that. Level 3, you'd have some difficulty. Also, just bearing in mind that Scientology wasn't a procedure which was applied by an auditor to a pre-clear, where my procedure is a do-it-yourself procedure, which throws an entirely different flavour on the proceedings. I had to be... All the time I was researching this material, I had to be very, very careful and bear in mind continuously that there's no separate therapist present, that the subject is the subject and the operator. He's both operator and subject. And this means that he has to proceed with considerable caution. And it means that the steps have to be very, very precise and so forth. And... But certainly when you get to level 5, level 4 would be a bit tricky to evaluate against Scientology, but level 5, no, there's nothing vaguely in Scientology like level 5, and level 5 is the key step in my procedure. All the earlier steps lead up to level 5. That's the one that does the trick, that's the beauty, that's the gem there, and there's nothing in Scientology you can evaluate it against. Simply there isn't anything there technically. So poor old Des, I feel for him. I feel for him. And by the time you get this tape, no doubt he will have gone through his agonies of trying to figure out the significance of this, and trying to say, gee, I wonder what would happen if he was to put that poster up there and do exactly what Dennis said. Now, what would happen? Oh, gee, I wonder what that mass is over there that just went past. Gee, that seemed to be significant. And then what's Greg saying? You know, he'd be doing the technique and trying to do it, at the same time evaluate the technique, and which you can't do. You would have to, in other words, to do the job properly, he would have to sit down and do the techniques. He'd have to do level 5, and he can't do level 5 until he's done the earlier steps on a solo basis. He could do level 5 with a separate therapist. Anyone could do that whose case is in pretty good shape. They could do it with a level 5 with a separate therapist, but it'd be a long and laborious procedure. It really would. But no one can do level 5 solo without doing levels 1, 2, 3, and 4. And even having done solo auditing in Scientology isn't going to get them off the hook, because the solo auditing in Scientology was not solo auditing. It never was. It was being audited by Ron Hubbard via the printed page. And that isn't what you do when you do TROM, mate. You're on your own, you know. There's just you and your meter. Or maybe there's not even a meter. You know, you're on your own. There's no printed page. There's just the instructions. You know, you just have to follow the instructions and do it. In other words, you go in and you put your swimming trunks on and jump in the pool. And you learn to swim. And I've given it an easy gradient, so you go in the easy end of the pool, and you first of all you get your toes wet at level 1, and then you get your ankles wet at level 2, and by the time you get to level 5 you're swimming. You know how to do it, but you couldn't possibly do level 5 solo without having done levels 1 to 4 solo, and there's no other way to do it except to do those four levels. No amount of auditing you've had in Scientology is going to help you. You're going to have to do it solo by yourself. I'm sorry it has to be that way, but that's the way it is. That's the way I had to learn to do it. Why I had to, day after day, when I was doing my research, putting myself on an e-meter and testing each step and finding out what was happening and evaluating this and keeping my notes up to date and keeping an eye on my sanity and seeing what this mass meant and so forth. It all had to be, the job had to be done, you know, and I did the job. So when I say I feel for poor old Des Profum, I really do. I really do feel for him. And if he's seriously approaches the job seriously, he'll realise that you're asking him to do a monumental task. Because there's nothing in his experience there in Scientology which is going to help him evaluate the upper levels of my tech at level 5. There's just simply nothing there. He can't say. No one can say until they've done it. Then they'll know. I'm sorry it has to be this way, Terry. But nevertheless, I'll be interested to get Des's report there. If he gives it the approval, or whether he gives it the thumbs down. Really, I don't mind whichever way he does it. I mean, I know it works. So if he gives it the thumbs down, well, that just means he didn't evaluate it properly. It means that he was assigned an impossible task, and he didn't quite get it right. But I'd forgive him for that, because he can't get it right until he's tried it. He'd have to do it. He'd have to do the practical before he could evaluate it. There's nothing in Scientology that would help him evaluate level 5. Now, does that, you see what I'm getting at here? Does that help you? That's why I'm, you know, that's what I mean when I say poor Des Profum. Been listening to your tapes and more, Terry. Yeah, some of the jobs we all did when we were young men. You know, when you said on your tape that one of the jobs you did was a clerk with the gas board at Southend-on-Sea. You know, that sounds so utterly dull. You know, it could almost come out of the Goon Show, couldn't it? You know, he was a clerk with the gas board at Southend-on-Sea. It's pure Goon Show material, that is. You know, I mean, I had one myself. One of my earliest jobs when I left school was I was a junior audit clerk
in the firm of Hacker Rubens, a firm of chartered accountants in Upper Regent Street. You know, I mean, how utterly dull can you get? Just 40 or 40 hours or 44 hours of sheer unrelieved tedium, week after week. Oh dear, the lives we led when we were young men. You got off that rat run, and I got off it too. But you had a very varied career. You've done very, very different sorts of jobs, and so have I. I've already mentioned that one of the jobs I did was as a weather observer. Also, of course, I was a musician, almost a professional, but certainly a working semi-professional musician for many years as a young man, again before I came across Dianetics and Scientology. But look, I won't go into any great details about my personal life or professional life on this tape, Terry, because it's covered in the initial stages of the Scientology reminiscences. It's background material at the beginning of the Scientology reminiscences of Ann and I on those tapes. So there's a pretty good rundown of my early life on there. So I won't repeat it on this tape here. It'll just be duplicating the material. Just suffice to say that like yourself, I too had a sequence of a very, very dull and uninspiring job. I think I'd better amplify what I said, what I meant when I said that there's no contradiction between TROM and Scientology, because this is an important thing. When I say that, I don't mean that in loosely. When a person says, people say, well, you know, there's no contradiction between these two things. They don't really say that in a, sometimes they don't mean that in a strictly logical sense. And when I say it, when I've said it, and when I say it, I mean it in a very, very strictly logical sense. So what exactly do I mean when I say that that there's no contradiction between the theory of TROM and the theory of Scientology? In other words, let me explain exactly what I mean when I say there's no contradiction there. Now, as far as a logician is concerned, and if two propositions are contradictory, what he means is that if one is true, then the other one is false. In other words, he's saying that they can't both be true. That's what it means to a logician. If two propositions are contradictory, then they can't both be true simultaneously. If one is true, then the other is false. For example, it's contradictory to say that a man went to China on a certain date, and then to say that that the same man didn't go to China on that date. You see, both those statements cannot both be true. It's a contradiction. He either went to China on that date, or he didn't go to China on that date. They can't both be true. That's a contradiction, you see. And that's what I mean when I say a contradiction. I'm being precise about this because I've heard this expression, that, you know, people would loosely say, oh, well, that's contradictory. And they don't really understand what they mean. In this context, I mean it exactly as a logician would say it, and I am a bit of an amateur logician, so that's exactly what I mean. Don't find a state of affairs where if some part of TROM is true, then that part of Scientology is false, or if this part of TROM is true, then that part of Scientology is false. We won't find that. That doesn't occur. There's no contradictions in the data. Another way to put this would be to say that TROM is consistent with Scientology, and Scientology is consistent with TROM. They can both be true together. The theory of TROM and the theory of Scientology are consistent with each other. There's no contradiction between them. Now, does that clarify exactly what I mean when I say that the TROM and Scientology, there's no contradiction between their theories. There may be contradictions between deductions from the theories. Some of the things that Ron might have said loosely in some of his lectures might contradict things in Trom, and some of the things I might loosely say about Trom might contradict some things in Scientology. But the actual essence of the theory of Scientology and the theory of Trom are consistent with each other, and they do not contradict each other. There's no contradictions. I think I've elaborated this sufficiently so that you understand exactly what I mean now when I say that there's no contradiction between the theory of Trom and the theory of Scientology. Really, what we have here, Terry, is two theories. We have the theory of Scientology and we have the theory of Trom. There's no contradiction between them. And I can give you an analogy from science there, say in the field of astronomy, where we have two theories, the situation is similar to the situation that exists between Trom and Scientology. In the early days of astronomy, they had what was called the Ptolemaic theory. That was the original theory of astronomy, which was based on the idea that the Earth was the centre of the universe, and that all the heavenly bodies revolved around the Earth. Everything, sun, moon, stars, revolved around the Earth. That was the Ptolemaic theory. And the astronomers, using the mathematics they had at their disposal, could make predictions from the Ptolemaic theory, and could actually predict eclipses and predict the positions of the heavenly bodies in the future. And lo and behold, when they made their observations with the scientific instruments at their disposal, they found that their predictions were true. So the Ptolemaic theory, there was nothing wrong with it. You could predict the positions of the heavenly bodies, and it stayed in existence for many hundreds of years. It was a perfectly good theory. It explained things. Then along came a guy called Copernicus, and he came along with a different theory. His theory was that the sun was a star, and that the Earth was a planet, and the Earth was moving around the sun. And he also strongly implied, although I don't know whether he actually said it as such, he implied that the sun too might be moving. But nevertheless, his was a different theory. He didn't put the Earth at the centre of the cosmos. You see, he more or less tended to say that the sun was at the centre and everything was moving around the sun. Although he might have admitted that the sun was moving too. I'm not a good enough astronomer to know exactly what Copernicus said. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. But he came along with a different theory. Now, using his theory, you could predict the positions of the heavenly bodies, you could predict the eclipses. And, what was the difference? Well, the only difference between the two theories was that it was simpler to predict. The math was simpler, the mathematics was much easier using Copernicus's theory than using the Ptolemaic theory. I mean, either could predict the eclipses and predict the positions of the heavenly bodies, but the Ptolemaic theory needed some pretty hairy mathematics to do it. The Copernicus theory was a piece of cake. It needed much easier math. So, of course, the astronomers, being, I suppose, essentially lazy men at heart, didn't care for all this tedious mathematics of the Ptolemaic theory, so they dropped it and went on to the Copernican theory, in line with a principle of science called Occam's razor, that you don't unnecessarily complicate, you don't unnecessarily dream up hypotheses, and you keep it simple. This is the essence of Occam's razor. If a simpler theory explains the phenomena, we'll use the simpler theory. Don't go along and unnecessarily complicate the situation with a complicated theory when a simple theory leads to a more simpler understanding of the situation. So, of course, the astronomers junked the Ptolemaic theory, dropped it, and went on to the Copernican theory. Well, now, would it be true to say that the Ptolemaic theory was wrong? Well, not really. I mean, it did explain it. You could use it. It was a workable theory. The Copernican theory was a better theory. But both of them The Copernican theory itself had to be modified. Along came Einstein and started talking about light being a constant velocity, and then we went into Einstein's celestial mechanics, and that had to be modified. So Copernican theory had to be modified, you see. But all the time they're approaching closer and closer to an understanding of what's going on up there, you see. So it's not strictly true to say that the Ptolemaic theory was wrong or the Copernican theory was wrong. It's just that the theories were superseded by better theories that were better in certain aspects. You see that? They were simpler, better in certain aspects. And that is essentially what we've got with Trom and Scientology. That the theory of Trom does explain certain phenomena better, and from this explanation allows us to do things more simply with Trom that can only be done in a very, very complex manner or in a more complex manner with Scientology. And that really is the total difference. Trom doesn't invalidate Scientology, it complements it completely. And there's nothing in Scientology which invalidates anything in Trom. You see that? The two subjects are consistent with each other. There is actually, Terry, two areas here that we're looking at. The first is a theoretical level, which I'll give you, where Trom gives a much more fundamental understanding of a phenomena. Now, this is this phenomena of erasure. Now, anyone who's ever dealt with Scientology and audited and so forth is familiar with the subject that you can actually erase things out of the human psyche. Various misemotions, various pains, various upsets. Misemotion, pain, upset and so forth can be erased out of the human psyche. And Scientology and Dianetics have a technique for doing this. Notwithstanding the physicists and the materialists who say that once an impression is made in the mind, it's there forever. And once the moving finger having writ moves on, not the one word of thy can say can change one half a word of it, and so on, drone, drone, drone. You see, these guys were wrong as far as the human mind was concerned. It is possible to erase things out of the human mind. Ron discovered this. This is a tremendously great discovery of his, and he embedded it in his engram theory. And he talked about erasure in 1950 in Book 1, and it worked. Those of us who tried it found that it was so, that you could erase it. By the end of 1950, I was erasing engrams on pre-clears and having them erased on me. And there was no doubt that they were gone. That Ron was right. In other words, anyone who cares to test Hubbard's theory, his engram theory, will find that it's a valid theory. And if you do it exactly as he says it in Book 1, you get the erasure. Okay. But he never gave an explanation of the phenomena in terms of his own subject, in terms of the elements of his own subject. He just said that if you do so-and-so and so-and-so, the engram will erase. You run through it, and you go earlier if necessary, and you follow this pattern. In other words, you work according to the rule. If you work according to the rule, the engram will erase. And there was the engram theory, the theory of the engram, the reactive mind, the A equals A, and all the bric-a-brac of the engram theory, which was a model for the human mind. It's a very good model for the human mind. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a good model. There, and he said, if you follow, there's the model, there's the theory, and if you do follow the steps, you will get the erasure. And lo and behold, you did it, you get the erasure. But he didn't explain why he erased. He never was. He never did. Nowhere in Scientology will you find the explanation. Now, in Trom, we have an explanation for erasure. I can explain thoroughly the phenomena of erasure in the human mind. Why it explains, why it erases. The explanation lies in the theory of complementary on and opposing postulates. You understand that that's in Trom. You'll find it there, written in Trom. If you once you understand the theory of complementary and opposing postulates, you will see what things erase in the mind. You will understand it in terms of postulates. And that is an understanding that Ron never had in Scientology. He never had it. He didn't know that. I discovered it. So Trom has that fundamental basic understanding, which is missing in Scientology. It doesn't make Scientology wrong. Scientology was right as far as it went. It didn't have that understanding. My Trom goes one step further and says, right, here's erasure. This is how it comes about. There is a subject of opposing postulates and a subject of complementary postulates, and they're defined as so-and-so, a complementary postulate is so-and-so, so-and-so, an opposing postulate is so-and-so, so-and-so, and this is how you get an erasure. And when the erasure occurs, da-da-da-da-da in terms of the postulates. See? It's all in Trom. Yeah. And you look at it and say, my God, that's why it erased. See? That's why the erasure in terms of postulates. In other words, I took the subject of erasure and I've related it to the subject of postulates, which Ron never did do. He couldn't do it because he didn't know it. God, the contributions the man made, he didn't get it all. He didn't live long enough. He didn't get it all. He made enormous contributions. So it's not a mistake on his part that he never got it. God, it took me 5 years to find it. So Ron has to be excused for not finding it, you know. So there is the, if you want to see the bottom line, there is the basic contribution on a theory level that I've made. And because of that contribution, and because in Trom we have an understanding of erasure, we can do this thing that Scientology could never, never do. We could approach the subject of the mind solo on a gradient scale. We could teach a person to take their own mind apart. Because we knew exactly what was in there now, you see. We knew exactly, if a thing wasn't erasing, we knew why. Because we knew the mechanics of erasure, which Scientology didn't really understand. But Trom understands it. So we can now, on a gradient scale, knowing exactly what erasure is, we can set a series of steps which a person can do solo, all by themselves, which will teach them how to erase their mind. That is why Trom is the resolution of mind. It is exactly that, the resolution of mind. It comes from a fundamental understanding of erasure in terms of postulates, and specifically in terms of complementary and opposing postulates. An understanding of the subject of erasure. You see, in Scientology, we never did, because we didn't know exactly what erasure was in terms of postulates, it was never completely safe to let a person run solo. You know, Ron himself in book one, he talked about the engram bank overwhelming the analytical mind, the reactive mind overwhelming the analytical mind. And this is true. It does. It can. Any person's experienced this. We've all experienced it. We get very angry and we say and do things that we don't really mean. And that when we cool down, we realize that, my God, what did I say? What did I do? That moment of anger where the analytical mind snapped in and the analytical mind went out the window. Ron reported these facts, observed it, and said that the analytical mind, the reactive mind, can come in and the analytical mind shuts off. It's true. There's a description there. It is true what he said. So without this very, very basic understanding of erasure in terms of postulates, it simply isn't safe to let a person off running solo on their mind. Ron, you got round this. He was aware of the problem of, you say, well, we can do it by lists. He used to, hand out great lists of processes. You just read down the page and follow the list of instructions on the page, and there's all the significances. He had this in his OT2. Remember the implant GPMs? You just read them off, fire them off on the meter and so forth. And it all works out. Yes, it's true, it does. But don't call it solo auditing, because it isn't. You're being audited by Ron Hubbard via what's on the list. Solo auditing is when you actually start punching things in your own mind, your own ideas, your own thoughts, and your own mind, and then looking and seeing what happens, then handling what happens, then punching some more things in. That's Trom, man. You see, that's different. There's no prepared list. You're doing it yourself. You're learning how to swim. You're learning how to resolve your own mind. You're taking it apart. Now, has this got any advantages over Scientology? Yes, it has. It has one enormous advantage over Scientology. Apart from the theoretical aspect, the fact that we have a theoretical understanding of erasure that we don't have in Scientology, we have this fact. Ron always, one of his goals, he always wanted to clear the planet. But look, I knew it, and all us, anyone who's thought about this, I knew this back in 1955. There was a fly in the ointment. Either we was going to have to train auditors up, and they're going to have to audit each other on a co-audit basis, or it wasn't going to happen. There was no way that the average person was going to be able to afford professional auditing. So the planet was not going to get cleared on a professional basis. You can't do it that way. Ron had the right idea in 1950 when he said, this is Dianetics, any two people can do it. While he kept that line going, there was a chance that the planet was going to get cleared. But once he started talking about professional auditing and professional training, all of which cost vast amounts of money, which not everyone possesses, out the window goes the goal of a cleared planet. But with Tron, we can have a cleared planet. Because it's do-it-yourself. A person can actually take the data of Tron, use it, and clear themselves completely. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I can tell you that when your person is completed up to the top of level 5, and I have, there's not one shred of process or technique in Scientology that is not utterly and completely flat on your case. This happened to me, long before I completed level 5. All the OT steps, right up to OT8, and I know them all, every one of them was flatter than a flounder on me. Because I'd done Tron. See? You see it? You see what I'm getting at here? So there's nothing in Scientology that isn't in Tron. You can dispense that. There isn't anything there. There's nothing in there. There's nothing in Scientology that isn't in Tron. But there's a simplicity in Tron that's not in Scientology. This is the understanding of erasure and the gradient scale to it, and the fact that it leads, it makes solo auditing safe, and it can lead to a cleared planet. We can clear the planet with Tron. You can't clear it with Scientology. The trouble with Scientology, or you could say loosely, or organisationally, the trouble was that it fell into the hands of the capitalists, it fell into the hands of the financiers, it became a profit-making venture. Once that happened, it was doomed, became just another business. And you never achieve truth through business, mate. Business is a game. you don't ever achieve any truth or any enlightenment by playing games. That's in Tron. Of course, the Buddhists know it too. Many spiritual healers and so forth, men of wisdom, have known this, that you there's no enlightenment by playing games. You have to stop playing games in order to get enlightenment. But anyway, you get the point. Now, what are the dangers of Tron? What are the liabilities and dangers? The biggest liability and danger of Tron to Tron is people will alter it. That is the biggest liability. The first typing, I'll give you some idea of this. When Greg typed up put the write-up into his computer from the TypeScript there onto his floppy disk, he put it in the hands of a secretary, a girl who didn't know very much about the mind and so forth, and it was a dog's breakfast. I've got the corrections to do, and it was absolutely incredible. I mean, it was almost as if this work had been given to a chimpanzee to walk over the typewriter. The mistakes were incredible. This poor girl, I God knows what was happening to her when she was typing up this stuff, you know. It must have been knocking up to 6. It must have been knocking her out of present time. Because she just simply could not duplicate it. So Trom is not going to be an easy one to duplicate for the person who is enmeshed in games play. I mean, all that's wrong with this poor girl was she was probably a compulsive games player. And compulsive games players have difficulty understanding truth, understanding enlightenment, understanding reason, understanding erasure, understanding complimentary prostitutes. They have difficulty with this because they're fixed in a compulsive game situation. All of this is explained in Trump, the compulsive games condition, compulsive game. While the person is in a compulsive game, they will compulsively alter his Trump. So that's the biggest difficulty I foresee with the subject there of Trom is it will be altruist. Then there will be a small minority of those who feel threatened by Trom. Anyone who's making in the central org, if there are any such people in the central org, who are making $1 million out of peddling Scientology at inflated prices, is not likely to take kindly to a do-it-yourself psychotherapy, which works, and a person can do it by themselves. And they end up into a state where everything that they've got to offer is flat. Flat, flat, flat. Flatter than a flounder. Flat. End. Gone. The mind's resolved. And it hasn't cost the person a dime. It hasn't cost them a cent except the purchase of the original Trump, which is going out at cost, so help me. See that? Now, any person who's got a vested interest in that line will probably come after me with a machine gun. Because I'm threatening, Trom is threatening their livelihood. But they won't know it. They won't believe it. Because they're in a compulsive game condition. And there's the safety factor. They simply won't believe it. I look at Trom. I look at, oh no, that's a squirrel. Stevens is a squirrel. He always was a squirrel. Dennis Stevens is squirreling on Scientology. It's just another field squirrel technique, says this top flight Scientology org executive, you know. And he, oh well, you know, he was declared years ago, he's a squirrel. You know, right, that's the end to it. Fine, good, lovely. Meanwhile, people are using Trump. See that? They won't believe it. Only those who try it and use it will know it's true. And they'll chuckle. So the biggest danger is that it gets altruist. While it stays in an unaltruist form. And as far as I know, the bit you've got there, what you have on your floppy disk is altruist. There may be one or two little spelling mistakes, but as far as I know, you have as near as damn it a pristine version of Trom as Greg and I can get, or at least as Greg can get. I haven't seen the final proofs yet, but Greg assures me that. That he's checked it and double checked it. He can't find anything except the odd spelling mistake. But he's going to send me a typed up copy of it. He's going to run it off for me. And when I receive it, I'll do the final checks on it. But he's quite confident that there won't be any final checks to do it. He staked his reputation on it, that there's no altruism in the text. He sweated blood over this one, Greg has, because he knows how important it is. Now, what sort of people are going to take to Trom? I can tell you that right away. Well, those who've had a fair bit of auditing and whose cases are in pretty good case shape, or a person whose case is naturally in good case shape, who maybe never had much auditing, but they're not in a particularly heavy gain, compulsive gain condition. In other words, precisely, anyone who's not in a compulsive games condition and who has a wish to take their mind apart and has some knowledge of the mind and so forth, and coming across Trom might be inclined to use it, and they would quickly find that it worked. And they're the ones that will use it with great benefit and very quickly get case gains from it. In other words, almost anyone that's had a whack of Scientology auditing and had a good case gains from their Scientology auditing got good results. People like yourself, I mean, you went into Scientology, your first session you had with running some happiness processes there with gold balls and so forth, you got a case gain. You're an easy running case, man. You could run well on trial, I'll tell you now. You told me that as soon as you talked about the golden balls and the group auditing and the having this session you ran. I thought, oh, hello, this guy's all right. He's an uptown person. He had no trouble at all. He ran easily on Trump. If you had told me, well, I walked into Hazy back in 1956 and well, this guy sitting out the front there and he was asking me some silly questions. He was asking me to imagine some gold book, golden balls. Well, there was no gold. Well, all the gold's in Fort Knox. We know there's no gold. There was no gold in that room. And he was asking me, who could imagine golden balls? And the man was an idiot. I mean, it was just a waste of money. Well, if you'd have told me all that, I'd have said, this person's going to have trouble with Trump. I mean, this guy is, you know, such a person is so thoroughly enmeshed in the meshed universe, in the compulsive games play of the physical universe that, you know, he hasn't got even half an eye out. He's going to have a lot of trouble with Trump. But this sort of person would have a lot of trouble in Scientology too. You know, an auditor would have trouble auditing such a person with such a prickly, because the guy's just too far in. He's ploughed in. It'd take a while to dig him out. Well, he'd have trouble with Trump too, you see that. So the higher up tone scale the person is, in talking Scientology terms, but more precisely, the less compulsive game player the person is. That's the key datum. If they're in compulsive game play, they'll have trouble in Scientology auditing, and they'll have trouble with Trump. If they're good, not compulsive, not in a highly compulsive games condition, they'll get good case gains in Scientology auditing, and they'll take to a Trom like a duck to water. Mind you, we live in a society where it's not considered the damn thing to tamper with thy own psyche. I mean, I can understand you getting Des Popham to come along and do a technical rundown on this material. I mean, I'm offering a do-it-yourself therapy. I mean, anyone who believes Dennis Stevens and starts actually doing these techniques is putting their sanity at risk. I do understand this. I do understand this. I put my sanity at risk when I research this area. So I do understand other people being cautious, and everyone should be cautious. Because it's... because caution is needed in the area of do-it-yourself therapy. But I've bent over backwards to make this material as safe as it's humanly possible to make it. And because of the basic understanding of erasure and so forth, and it allows me to put those steps together which lead up to level 5, which leads into the resolution of mind. I mean, you look at level 3, you dig out level 3, time breaking is an absolutely fascinating subject. If you thoroughly understood time breaking, Terry, you would understand why a person has a need for a separate therapist. You see? And also you understand how not to need a separate therapist. If you can time break, you no longer need a separate therapist. That's the whole of level 3, you know. The person goes into level 3, he's still with a nagging feeling that he ought to have a separate auditor. He walks out the other end of level 3, he knows that he's waved goodbye to separate therapist forever. He doesn't need a separate therapist. Oh, he doesn't mind. He doesn't mind if Bill drops in with an email and says, hey, how about a session? Sure, he is. Shut the cans, yeah, sure. What do you want me to do? I mean, I don't mind being audited by somebody else. Be somebody else can audit me any old time. I don't mind. But I got to move fast, because I move pretty darn fast as a PC these days, and they probably have a lot of difficulty following the way I'm going. It would be inhibitive of case gains working with a separate therapist, and it would be to work solo. Work faster solo than I can with a separate therapist. But that doesn't mean to say that I can't. A person who worked on Trump can't work with a separate therapist. They can. They work like a dream with a separate therapist, but they can also work solo. So again, you see, the two subjects are consistent with each other. a person who's taken Trump therapy, he's not denied anyway the benefits of a separate therapist in Scientology. He can settle into session and run Scientology with the best of them. They make probably better case gains than any other pre-clear that's not on Trump. He knows what he's doing. He knows what's going on. Now, one of the difficulties I have, Terry, is I don't know really what's going on in the Church of Scientology these days. I've been out of touch with them for so long, you know. And I don't know what they're doing. I don't know how sincere they are. I don't know how much they've altered Ron's techniques. I don't know how much of the old man's original material is still extant. I do know that a few years ago I picked up a copy of Dianetics and Modern Science of Mental Health. This would have been about six, seven years ago. I picked up a copy of Dianetics and Modern Science of Mental Health in the local library, in the local public library in Sydney, and it bore little resemblance to the copy that I received in 1950. It was only a ghost. There's only the barest resemblance to the original that came out in 1950. It had been just chopped to pieces. Some maniac who had a vest, to my mind when I read it, I said to Anne, I said that some maniac who has a vested interest in keeping the reactive mind in existence has gone through Dianetics with a large pair of scissors, which has hacked the original book to pieces. Without actually cutting it all out and leaving just the covers behind, you know. Somebody was trying to cut out the truth that Ron talked about in Dianetics in 1950. Some compulsive game player who had a vested interest in keeping the reactive mind in existence. So I don't know what they're doing down there these days. I don't know what they're doing down there these days, Terry, in the church. You say you're an independent. I don't know. We don't have such things over here in Australia as independents. We have a field of old-timers who've done training and more or less sitting out in the field. Most of us have been declared. We're all squirrels as far as the all's concerned. We're all glad to be out of it. And there's a group of young people get swept up off the streets into the Scientology organisations and offered courses and auditing at incredibly expensive prices, and using tech, which, well, talking to Greg recently, he says some of the tech down there is pretty scary these days. It's got very little resemblance to what Ron Hubbard was talking about. Now, I'm not a man to press on hearsay, so I won't pass on hearsay, because it's only hearsay I've got it from Greg, so I don't know. I won't say it. But I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. And once the old man came off those lines, and that org fell into the hands of the financiers, where the bottom line is profit, and then more profit and profit, well, under those circumstances, truth has a habit of going out the window. When the bottom line is profit, truth takes an awful beating, it does. The bottom line is profit. That's probably the worst thing that ever happened to the Scientology organisations, was it fell into the hands of the financiers. It became a profit-making organisation. If they'd have kept it like Christian Science, you know, like the Christian Scientists. Now, they were a smart crowd, they were. They never turned into a profit-making organisation. It was a church, the Church of the Christian Scientists. They have their little buildings and people can go in and study. They don't charge very much. Most of their stuff's free. And they you know, it's all very, very low-key. And they have a tremendous amount of wisdom in there and so on. They've been going for years and years and years. Well, there was the mock-up for Scientology. It was the same mock-up, the same organisation structure as the Christian Scientists. And Scientology with the one hands down. To make it into a profit-making organisation while still trying to call it a church, oh man, that was really something. But that's the way. Well, Ron was a son of his culture in the Western, in America. He only understood profit. He only understood business, because he came from a country where profit is king, profit is God. In the beginning. You know, in America, the word is, in the beginning there was profit. And from profit, God was created. And then God created the universe. That's the cry of the businessman. And this sort of attitude is quite inimical to wisdom and the resolution of mind and enlightenment and so forth. The two are completely, you know, they're just inimical. They're contradictions. They're contradictions in terms. You know, you can't have enlightenment, wisdom, and so forth, where you have this this profit, because profit is a game. It's a games condition, and so it becomes a compulsive games condition. So it becomes virtually opposed to enlightenment. There's no enlightenment in the compulsive games condition, and business and profit is a compulsive games condition. It's all written up in Tron. It's all there. You can pick it up yourself and you read the materials there. The goal to exploit is unerasable. It's in Tron. I don't know if it's actually in the write-up or whether it's in one of these supplementary tapes. It might be in one of the supplementary tapes. But you've only got to look at the unerasable goals packages at level 5B and the goal to exploit, the goal to profit. They were both unerasable goals packages. I'll tell you that gratis, you know. It's there. I'll tell you that they're quite unerasable at level 5B. So that tells you right away that there's no enlightenment to be had in the field of business, because business is based on the subject of profit and exploitation. So you get involved in business, you're immediately into a compulsive games condition, and you're in trouble. No enlightenment there. That's really what happened to Scientology. It got itself into business, and it got itself into a compulsive games condition, and it just started to fall apart. So I don't know what they're doing down there now. I suspect that in the church these days they've got violent not-isness and alterisness of everyone's data. One way or another, they're chopping the old man up into little bits and making him profitable. Because some of the early writings of the old man weren't very profitable, were they? You know, any two can do it. Co-auditing, any two can do it. Just buy the book. Oh, how can we make a profit out of that? Oh, we'll have to tear that bit out of the book, won't we? No. Stop publishing that book. No two people can do it. The only way to do it is come in here and put your $20,000 on the counter, and then we might be able to help you. That's the only way you can get helped, and it's the only way I can make a profit. That's business. But it isn't truth. Well, I'm sort of filling this tape up, Terry, you know. I'm getting towards the end of it. I'm determined not to send you any blank tape. Still got a few minutes to go. But I think I've covered the material pretty thoroughly. What I'll do, I'll pause here and replay and see if I've missed anything, and then come and finish off. Yes, I've played this over, Terry. It sounds all right. I'm a bit close to the microphone in one or two points. There may be a bit of distortion here, but I'll Dolbyize the as my wont. I'll Dolbyize the tape before I send it to you, so you can get the cut the background noise down on the tape. So it'll be, there's a Dolby NR. So you may have to cut your tone control back a bit when you replay it. Otherwise, it'll be very scratchy. But I have, my experience does tell me that it's best to Dolbyize. The recipient of the tape does get the best. Possible reproduction if the tape is Dolbyized at source. Now, the best thing I can say in conclusion is to quote the last paragraph from Tron. I'll read the last paragraph to you, and I think it will summarize what I've been talking about there, and the flavor of what I've been talking about on this tape. Here's the last paragraph of Tron, right up, which you have a copy of on your floppy disk. Here we go. Quote, "Those who read this work and, resisting the temptation to sit around and talk about it forever, actually do the exercises and discover that they work just as described, may care to mention the fact to others, including their children. Then, if we so desire, and if we work at it, we will be able to create a civilization on this planet of which we can be truly proud. The choice is ours." End of quote. Now, I couldn't put it better than that. The temptation is that for people to simply sit around and sit on their backsides and talk about Tron forever, say, "Oh, it's a marvellous thing, and Dennis Stevens has done a marvellous job." And I've been hearing this for years, you know. People get in touch with me, say, oh, it's marvellous, this, it's very good, very good. I say, well, how far have you got? I say, oh, I'm still finishing, I've still got this action cycle to finish there. I've got my Freudian psychoanalysis to complete, and I'm halfway through OT94, and I've got this half an engram to run. And I say, well, when are you going to get around and do some TROM? And that's the last I hear, you know. That's the last I tend to hear on the subject. People seem to spend 1,000 reasons why they won't get started, why they won't put their toe in the water. It's largely cultural, because we live in a society where it's not considered the done thing to tamper with your own mind. Now, the reason for this is because there's a compulsive games condition between the human spirit and his own mind. This means that he's either... This compulsive gain condition means that he's either an operator, he's an auditor, and he's auditing a mind, which is in the class of not-self. In other words, it's not his mind he's working on. Or if it's his mind that's being worked on, he's not the operator, he's the subject, and somebody else is doing the operating. So you see the situation that he gets himself into in the compulsive gain condition. He can't be easily in a situation where he's both the operator, the auditor, and the subject, the preclear, which is what he has to do in TROM. He has to be both subject and operator. And it's possible to do it. The only thing that prevents him from doing it is because he's in a compulsive games condition with his own mind. And the only way he'll break the compulsive games condition with his own mind is to do therapy. He can do it, he can break the games condition with Scientology, but while he has a separate auditor in Scientology, he's not likely to break this compulsive games condition, because he'll endlessly depend upon the separate auditor. Eventually he's going to have to get off this rat run and stop depending on the separate auditor, break the compulsive games condition between himself and his own mind, and start doing TROM, and start becoming both operator, both auditor and preclear, and work through TROM. It can be done. I can do it. I've done it. It can be done. Although it's true that the reactive mind can come in and cut out the analytical mind, it's also possible, and it's also, you can set the situation up like I have done with TROM. You can set the situation up so that the reactive mind never comes in sufficiently to cut out the analytical mind. That is the gradient scale I've chosen in TROM. The reactive mind simply never comes in enough to cut the reactive mind never comes in sufficiently to cut the analytical mind out of circuit, and so stop the auditing. So you press on, you keep going. But that's only because I'm using a very, very narrow gradient. Now, this fact escaped Ron. But no, I've overput that. That's unfair. Because Ron never understood the basics of erasure, he was doomed. He knew that he didn't have solo auditing going on. He knew that. He was too clever. He knew that. So no, that's an unfair remark. But we can do it with TROM, because we know about erasure, and we know about postulates, and we know what the score is. So we can do it. We can do it on a narrow gradient, and we can keep the analytical mind in circuit and take the reactive mind apart. The person can be both the auditor and the preclear simultaneously. You simply put your swimming trunks on, you start in a level 1 and get your toes wet. Then you get into level 2 and you get your ankles wet, and by the time you get to level 5, you're swimming. And really, there isn't any more I can say about it, Terry. So I better wind this tape off before it gets off the end of the spool. Been nice talking to you. You're free to use this material I've given you on this tape. You can communicate it to anyone you like. I don't mind. The data's quite free. And all the best, and I hope to hear from you soon. Bye-bye for now.